court's ready to hear argument in Smith v. State. Are you ready to proceed? Very well.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacob.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Phil Renzulli. I'm from the Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant here in James Smith. Essentially, what we're here for to decide are two issues that we addressed in our appellant brief regarding motions to suppress and competency. If the court wishes, I'll proceed first with the suppression issue, unless the court desires me to address the competency issue first. What we're here to determine, I'm not going to really go into the facts of the case because I'm sure the court is aware of the facts regarding the suppression issue. Essentially, we're cognizant of the fact that the court gives great deference to the trial court regarding findings of fact in the suppression case, and they're reluctant to reverse unless there's findings of facts that are clearly erroneous. In that regard, what I'll try to present to the court is that what our position is as to what these facts are that are clearly erroneous. As the court is aware, this is a situation where we have a 14-year-old boy who was brought in for questioning by the police and accompanied by his mother. And well, there is some disputes in the facts regarding whether the mother was allowed to be present during the interview. There was a interview actually
conducted.
Whether
she was present or allowed to be present?
Allowed to be present.
Right. And I thought the record showed the officer said, we're going to go down the hall and interview your son.
Yes, that's what he said. And later on he says that she never gave the request to be present in the interview. And there was a dispute by her later on in her testimony that she did request that. Now, there was...
And then the trial judge said she found the officer to be more credible in that dispute. Is that correct?
It's a little unclear on that because she said there's a finding of fact as to whether he... advised her as to the nature of the charge, the allegation, why they're there. She found the officer credible there.
Well, that's a different issue. There was one question about whether she knew what was going on, and that's when the trial judge commented that she and her son both agreed that on the drive to the police station, they discussed whether something had happened involving his 3-year-old cousin. So the trial judge said she found it not credible that the mother said she didn't know what was going on when both she and her son admitted that they were talking about possible actions involving the 3-year-old cousin. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Our position is that they were essentially surmising what the situation was with the purpose of the interview, not that they're actually were cognizant based on any representation made by the police officer as the nature of the interview. But I don't think she really actually addresses specifically whether, under the totality of the circumstance test, whether the absence of a friendly adult in this situation from the interview is a factor that should be considered here.
Well, just, you know, in your brief, you say broadly, mm-hmm, that procedures weren't followed, but I couldn't identify the procedures as I kept reading your brief. So my first question is, what were the procedures that were not followed? My second question is, what are the implications at the hearing itself when the issue of unfair tactics during the interview came up and, you know, there was a representation on the record that the defense was waiving a challenge to unfair tactics by the police during the interview? So let's start first. Tell us the procedures that were not followed.
The procedure, I think what I was trying to express to the court during my brief and probably didn't make it completely clear is that the procedure was that the parents should be we know the parent was notified as to the fact, and that procedure was clear. our procedure is that the officer did not advise her of, she had the right to be present during the interview. We base that on the mother's position as to that. I understand it was a finding of fact, and the court gives deference to that, to the trial court.
And what's the right to be present? That's a statutory right?
That's not a statutory right, and we acknowledge that the courts previously have ruled that this is not a determinative factor whether an issue is to be decided on suppression. But it is a factor to be considered in the totality of the circumstance.
All right. Test. Well, I apologize for interrupting you again.
That's fine.
But you're saying he should have told her that she had a right to be present. And my question is, did she have a right to be present?
It's our position that a parent who's accompanying her son to a police station and they wish to interrogate the child, if she's present, that she should be provided the opportunity to be present if she so chooses to be present.
So the answer is yes?
Yes. Yes. And I believe that you asked me as to the coercion issue, that there was some issue addressed. I noticed that in the appellee's brief. There was two issues raised in the suppression motion. Whether Title 10, Section 1004 was properly followed, and whether the waiver was knowingly and intelligently made. I raised the possibility of raising another issue regarding coercion as to something that took place later on down during the course of the interview, and that I may want to address that. Now, there was a situation after we addressed the 1004 issue as well as the issue of the Miranda waiver, after the court found against the appellant on those issues, I chose not to proceed regarding what occurred later on down the line during the course of the interview. That's why there was some discussion about playing the whole tape, because this issue pretty much occurred 40 minutes into the tape. And after the court ruled against us on the first two issues, which we felt were our strongest issues, I decided to waive that issue. That does not mean that I waived the coercion as to the issue of Miranda. That's a totally different thing. I addressed the whole issue of whether this was knowing, intelligently, voluntarily waived statement during the course of our argument. Now, I think what's crucial to our position, there's many factors that we think that the court should consider under the totality of the circumstances test. We know his age, experience, his educational background, his intelligence, all factors that the court should consider. We know this is a 14-year-old boy that was never arrested before. He's learning disabled. The officer knew he couldn't read, because he told them this during the course of the Miranda. There's further information another fact, as I already addressed, that should be considered under the totality of the circumstance test is the absence of a friendly adult. But where we get into a really, I think we're at the center of the analysis is the use by the police officer of a statement during the course of Miranda, which we found very interesting and curious. It's our position that the court is below stated that the way Miranda was given to the child was clear and unambiguous. We totally disagree with that. First of all, the only thing that was clear and unambiguous about the way Miranda was read was the very first part when he says you have the right to remain silent. And after that, it gets even more confusing. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. He tells a 14-year-old boy that what that means is that it's legal and pertinent. Then he gets to the third part where he addresses the right to counsel, and he says, don't worry, I spoke to your mom about that, and it's fine. Now, it's our position that this was meant to suggest to the child that the mother, outside of the interview room, waived Miranda. In fact, the officer, I believe during the state's
break. Where do you derive that from that one sentence that says, if you wish one, that is, if you wish a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
We've already talked to your mom about that, and that's fine.
Okay. And then if you
if there's any inference that seems to logically flow from that, it's that, you know, we talked to your mom, and if you want a lawyer, that's fine with us. Just tell us.
But the fact of the matter is that when you put that in along with what he testified that the mother told him that in the presence of the child that, no, we don't need a lawyer, that's not necessary. And that's also in the record. And
well, that may be, but we're talking now about whether the Miranda statement was clear. And it looks pretty clear.
At that point, it's our position that it does create an ambiguity. There's a certain level of ambiguity there, whether, especially if you look at the tape, he's sort of waving his hand, I already talked to your mom about that, and it's fine. And it creates a possibility to suggest to the child, objectively, you know, that issue is not really, you don't really have to worry about that.
It sounds to me as if what you're arguing in essence is that the Miranda warnings are not adequate when dealing with a child, and that in addition to the exact warnings that we all pretty much know by heart, that when you're dealing with a child, there has to be some real explanation of every aspect of it, of, well, you know, when I say that you have the right to an attorney, let me explain to you that you probably could use an attorney, and an attorney, it won't cost you anything, and an attorney can help you out, and, you know, you probably want an attorney, and so on and so forth. But is there any law in support of that position?
Well, I think it's basically under the totality of circumstances, there's inquiries as to whether the child understands Miranda in the way it was presented. So I think under that situation,
one could say, and I, just as a personal matter, I'm always amazed when people get Miranda warnings and say, fine, I'll talk to you. But the fact is that a person is being told, here are the consequences, in fairly plain language of, and here are your options. And having gone through that process, if the person wants to talk, they want to talk. I guess I'm having trouble, if you're not saying that there's some different warning that has to be given when you're talking about a child, then I'm having trouble understanding how there can be a problem with this set of warnings.
Well, that's not exactly what I'm saying. I think there should be explanation. I do agree with the court that there should be, I'm not saying that's your position, but I'm just saying that what you raise, that there should be some careful explanation as to what these rights mean when you're dealing with a very young child that especially has never had experience with the criminal justice system. You can't just read Miranda pro forma off the waiver form the way you would do to an adult. It's just not reasonable. They have different, a child of 14 has different maturity levels, developmental levels, and degrees of understanding that an adult has. And I think at this point the officer even acknowledges that during this interview, he testifies that he made an effort. Problem is, his effort makes the whole issue more confusing, because the way he explains it raises issues whether it's more ambiguous after his explanation than before.
Help me understand something about the ultimate convictions. I think there were five charges, and he was found to be delinquent on three and not on two. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, and the child testified. And as I read the record, his convictions were consistent with her testimony. Was there anything in his statement that was admitted that led to a conviction that would not have led to a conviction independently based on what the victim said.
Well, his statement was that, and this usually this occurred toward the end of the interview, because for the most part of the interview he denied any involvement. He admitted that there was sexual contact, but there was, the way he described it, occurred at a different time and place than what the girl did. So the court acknowledged in the end that they both admitted to two different contact, to two contacts, but the problem is that they were totally in two different places. That's the one thing that was inconsistent about it.
Well, we've used up all your time on your first issue. You can continue. You've got about 4.5 minutes left. Or do you want to reserve that?
Yes, I'd like to.
Good morning again.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. I'll address the second issue in the briefing, the suppression issue, but if the court has any questions about the first issue, the competency, I'll certainly try to address those. To some extent, some of the considerations in the competency question also impacted the suppression.
Well, can you start
motion.
With kind of a logical extension of Justice Berger's question? You know, we have someone here who's a juvenile, and not only a juvenile, but someone who's admittedly mildly retarded, and their parents present, but down the hall, and the person couldn't even sign their name to the statement after it was given, and during the course of the interview said they couldn't read. So we've got a mildly retarded juvenile who can't read and write, who's alone with a policeman, and he made a knowing and intelligent decision to incriminate himself. How should the court review that, just like we review everything else?
Well, I think in these suppression motions, it is a totality of the circumstances test. Ultimately, it's a question of abuse of discretion in the trial judge. She made a determination here that there was a valid waiver of the Miranda rights. And I think what's important here is, in looking at the totality of the circumstances, how this December 19 videotaped interview came about. The Newcastle County police officers were looking for Mr. Smith and his mother. They located them at a motel in Maryland. They went there. The officer talked with the mother, told them that her son was a suspect in a criminal investigation. At that time, the mother said, well, he's asleep and he's sick. He didn't go to school that particular day. And the officer said, well, fine, here's my card. When he feels better or wakes up, give me a call and we'll try to schedule something. I do need to talk with him, however. As the officers were leaving, the mother then came after them and said, well, he's awake now. And she wanted to go down to the police station, as she put it, to get the matter resolved at that point. The mother and son drive in their car and follow the police to the Newcastle County police station where the videotaped interview takes place. The mother is outside the interview room and the actual interview takes place, but the interview itself is on videotape. The family court judge, in deciding this suppression question, had the opportunity to view the videotape and to make appropriate factual findings and legal determinations. And what the trial judge found was that the individual, he was 14 years old, he was going to be 15, I believe, the next month. His birthday was in January, and this interview occurred in December. The trial judge made findings that the Miranda rights were, in fact, given, and that's what Miranda requires, is that the police give someone who is in custody and being interrogated an advisement of their specific rights. She also elaborated, that the trial judge did, that the officer made an attempt to explain some of the rights so that they would be at least more intelligible to the juvenile accused in this particular case. So I think, you know, the police did what they were legally required to do. They actually went a step further in trying to explain some of these matters. The family court judge who viewed the videotape said her analysis was that it was done in a non-threatening manner and that the police officer was making a good faith effort to try to explain some of these concepts to Mr. Smith. The overlay here, or the overlap, I guess, is the importance in looking at the competency testimony of Abraham Mensch, who was the only professional that testified at the pretrial competency hearing. And his assessment of the individual was that after some testing that he had a verbal IQ of 76, but his full-scale IQ was lower. It was a 67, and that was in the mild mental retardation range. The cases that this court and other courts have reviewed, those become more problematic when someone is in that area. The Oliver Randolph decision that this court rendered last year, that juvenile accused had an IQ of 77. There was a Superior Court case, I believe, from Kent County a couple of years ago involving an adult, Mr. Reed. His IQ was 64. So this individual, somewhere between Reed and Randolph in terms of the testing for the mental abilities here. But Dr. Mensch's testimony, he's a psychologist employed by the state, was that this juvenile was oriented in the three spheres. He was able to describe the court process in some general terms. He's certainly able to hold a conversation, and that the psychologist's impression was that he understood he was involved in a court proceeding that involved charges against him, and that he also understood he was supposed to speak, to talk with a lawyer whose job, the lawyer's job, was to assist Mr. Smith. So I think, you know, some of those determinations or those issues were addressed in the competency hearing, and based upon that testimony, which was the only expert psychological testimony officer offered at the competency hearing, that this individual did have capacity to make a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of the Miranda rights, as the trial judge found. There were some discrepancies as to the officer's recollection of the events and the mother's recounting, but this was a non-jury trial. The trial judge had to make determinations as to which witness she thought was more credible or believable in those circumstances. And
help us understand the consistency between the judge's two rulings. Because in the competency ruling, the judge talks about the fact this person's going to really need to work with their lawyer. They're going to need extra time to understand what's going on. And we'll make sure that the trial is extended so that he has plenty of time to have give and take with his lawyer to really understand what's going on and help him through this process. Then when we get to the Miranda side, we conclude that without the assistance of an attorney, he was able to decide he was going to waive the assistance of the attorney and deal with the police all on his own. How is that consistent?
Well, I think it's consistent because it's different context. The context of the suppression issue was whether or not the statement that the accused made to the police was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. The focus on the trial and competency to stand trial in the family court in a non-jury setting was whether or not this individual not only could understand what was being offered as evidence, but being able to actually assist his attorney in the particular case here. I think the important thing to bear in mind, though, is that the complaining witness, who was 3 at the time of the offense and I believe approximately 5 years old, she was a kindergartner at the time of trial, she does testify to the same thing. So there's evidence presented to the court, and the court makes determinations that there's sufficient evidence presented not only on the basis of the incriminatory admissions by the accused, but also the testimony of the complaining witness to sustain 3 of the charges.
What's your understanding of the law with regard to the parent's right to be present in these circumstances if the parent had said, insisted on being present?
I think if the parent insists on being present, they do have the right to do that. The question here was whether or not the mother had ever made such a request. The officer didn't acknowledge that she had. She testified that she did.
Is there any obligation to tell the mother she has that right?
I'm not sure if the statute says that or not. I know the statute says that the police, before they interrogate a juvenile, have to make an effort to locate either a parent or a guardian. But if they make that good faith effort, and there was a case, I believe it was LaVon Walker, where the police had interrogated the juvenile. They couldn't locate either of the parents. They couldn't locate any other responsible adult. And they went ahead, and it was a murder prosecution here in Kent County, and they went ahead and interrogated them in that case. So I think if the police have made a good faith effort to do that, that's all that's required. Now, if the mother wanted to be there, I think she had a right to be there, certainly. That would seem to be part and parcel of the statute. If there's an affirmative obligation on the police to try to locate this individual, the purpose must be so they can be present if they wish to be during any police interrogation. So
and
I think
wouldn't the logical extension of that be that the police have an affirmative obligation to, if they're successful in locating the parent, in informing the parent that we're going to interview your child, and if you want to, you have the right to be present?
Well, I think that would be appropriate, yes.
But that didn't happen here.
Well, I thought the officer told her that they were going to interview him down the hall.
Right, and I think that's perhaps an interesting point in terms of if you imagine a not too well-educated parent in arguably somewhat frightening circumstances involving her young child who's mentally retarded and who's told, okay, well, I'm going to go down the hall now and interview your son. Perhaps, you know, a more aggressive parent would say, well, wait a second, I want to come too. But unless the police officer said, and you can join us if you would like, why would the parent assume that all they had to do was say, oh, yeah, I want to come? You know, there seems to be a disconnect between saying, I'm going down the hall now, and saying, and you can join me. And as far as I can tell, there's no evidence that she was ever expressly told, you have the right to be there.
Well, then I think it's a question of to whom do you give the Miranda warnings? And the Miranda warnings are given to the accused. I mean, in this particular case, you know, the mother certainly had an idea what was going on. She was told at the motel before they ever left the state of Maryland to come here that he was the focus of a criminal investigation. And the officer also said that he told her that they were sexual in nature, the allegations. So she had some idea what was going on. And the defendant, the juvenile defendant, who did testify at the pretrial suppression hearing, he didn't actually testify at the trial, but he admitted that his mother advised him that the charges were being pressed against him. So there apparently was some interaction between the mother and the juvenile accused about what was going on. So she was certainly well aware of that. The juvenile, he also admitted that he was told that he had the right to remain silent prior to the police interview. That's at page 890 of the appendix.
Justice Berger's question is focusing on another aspect, and that's whether the parent should have been in the room. If the parent has to be told that they have the right to be there if they wanted to be, then they exercise that right. You have a whole different dynamic in the room. If the person, the parent also hears the giving of the Miranda rights and the person starts to waive them, then the parent can say, well, I'd like to talk to you first. That's not a good idea. Don't do that. And there are a lot of things that could happen between a child and a parent, let alone a child who's mentally retarded. But we never get to that scenario and the possible interaction if the parent's not in the room. So, you know, as a matter of precedent, what is the law or what should the law be with regard to saying to the parent, we found you, we want you to come to the police station because we want to interrogate your juvenile child, and you have a right to be there during the interrogation?
Well, I don't know that there's any statutory requirement. Statutory requirement simply imposes an obligation on the police to make the effort to locate the parent or guardian. That was done here. The mother was told what was going on and why the police wanted to talk to the son, so she was fully aware of that. I don't think the law goes any further than that, however. I mean, in the LaVon Walker case, the police never could find an adult, so Mr. Walker was simply interviewed by the Dover police with no adult present. But the police had made an effort, and that's as far as they could go in that particular case. I think here, though, the focus still has to be on whether two things. One, whether there's a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver by the juvenile of his rights. And if there is, then the statement's admitted. And then second, is this statement simply cumulative evidence given the other trial testimony that even if there was error and even if it was an abuse of discretion not to grant the suppression motion, is that error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And the state's position would be certainly, given the other trial testimony of the complaining witness herself, that it's cumulative in nature and has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. If there's any other questions on this issue or the competency issue, I'll certainly try to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll address the competency issue, unless the court wishes me to respond further on the suppression. My colleague here advised the court that there was only the defense expert testimony provided. There was no state expert testimony. And he advised this court that based on the expert testimony, the court found the juvenile was competent. But it was only not strictly based on the expert's testimony. There was the fact, the matter, that the court placed great emphasis on the fact that the tape was played during the course of the competency hearing. So although she didn't point out specifically in her opinion what questions were reasonable and what responses were rational, she advises that that the juvenile's responses led her to believe that he would be able to reasonably assist his attorney. Now that's completely vague because it's not supported by anything in the record as to what responses by the juvenile during the course of this interview would lead her to believe that those responses are rational and could therefore lead him to assist an attorney. The only evidence we have on the record as to the juvenile's responses at all are during the suppression motion. And if the court recalls, most of his responses to every question were either "I don't know" or "I don't remember." A couple of instances where he was able to recall and give some kind of response beyond that, but for the most part, there was very little recollection of events. And even so, even when I resumed my redirect after the state finished her cross and I revisited the Miranda after I read them to him the first time, 5 minutes later, he couldn't recall them. And the issues in this case were significantly complex regarding the location of various witnesses in the household at the time and the timing of these alleged contacts when there were so many people around the house. And so the fact that the juvenile is cognizant merely of the pertinent fact of what he's charged with, and from that alone, the court surmises that he therefore has intellectual, psychological, and maybe cognitive abilities to assist counsel later on when we're trying to explore more complex issues regarding the facts of the case is quite a leap. It's not enough that he's cognizant of the actual surroundings and the fact that there is a judge here and a prosecutor there. There are many factors in Smith, and you can always concentrate on two or three that will support your position and ignore the rest. But the fact of the matter is the ones she is ignoring are the ones that are very relevant both to competency and the suppression issue, is the child's intellectual capabilities. And it's clear that Dr. Mensch advises that he presents with serious deficits in this regard. And even with prompting, that there's no guarantee. And this is where the court feels that, well, we can take the time out, and if he explains it carefully to
were
him.
Were you permitted under the family court rules to retain your own expert to give an opinion on competency?
Well, we picked Dr. Mensch. Okay. He was the one we requested the competency evaluation, and normally our office uses Dr. Mensch. But the fact of the matter is there was discussion that she believed that there's sufficient prompting that the child would be able to respond, but Dr. Mensch says you can't rely on that because quite often with these special ed kids, they like to say, when in response to a question, do you understand, they'll say, yeah, I understand. But it's something you can't rely on because they're quite often they don't like to respond. Are embarrassed by the fight.
Thank you, Mr. Inzulli. Thank you, Mr. Williams. The court will take the matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.